and a breast of veal in the shape of a harp. Their servants cut our bread into cones, cylinders, parallelograms, and several other mathematical figures. After dinner, my company withdrew, and a person was sent to me by the king's order, attended by a flapper. He brought with him pen, ink, and paper, and three or four books, giving me to understand by signs that he was sent to teach me the language. We sat together 4 hours, in which time I wrote down a great number of words in columns, with the translations over against them. He showed me also, in one of his books, the figures of the sun, moon, and stars, the zodiac, the tropics, and polar circles, together with the denominations of many planes and solids. The word which I interpret the flying or floating island is in the original Laputa, whereof I could never learn the true etymology. Lap, in the old obsolete language, signifies high, and unta, a governor, from which they say by corruption was derived Laputa from Lapunta. But I do not approve of this derivation, which seems to be a little strained. I ventured to offer to the learned among them a conjecture of my own, that Laputa was quasi Laputed. Lap, signifying properly the dancing of the sunbeams in the sea, and uted, a wing, which, however, I shall not obtrude, but submit to the judicious reader. Those to whom the king had entrusted me, observing how ill I was clad, ordered a tailor to come the next morning and take measure for a suit of clothes. This operator did his office after a different manner from those of his trade in Europe. He first took my altitude by a quadrant, and then, with a rule and compasses, described the dimensions and outlines of my whole body, all which he entered upon paper, and in 6 days brought my clothes very ill-made and quite out of shape, by happening to mistake a figure in the calculation. But my comfort was that I observed such accidents very frequent and little regarded. His Majesty had given orders that the island should move northeast and by east to the vertical point over Legado, the metropolis of the whole kingdom below upon the firm earth. It was about 90 leagues distant, and our voyage lasted 4 days and a half. On the second morning, about 11 o'clock, the king himself in person, attended by his nobility, courtiers, and officers, having prepared all their musical instruments, played on them for 3 hours without intermission, so that I was quite stunned with the noise. Neither could I possibly guess the meaning, till my tutor informed me. He said that the people of their island had their ears adapted to hear the music of the spheres, which always played at certain periods, and the court was now prepared to bear their part in whatever instrument they most excelled. He said that the people of their island had their ears adapted to hear the music of the spheres, which always played at certain periods, and the court was now prepared to bear their part in whatever instrument they most excelled. Their ideas are perpetually conversant in lines and figures. If they would, for example, praise the beauty of a woman or any other animal, they describe it by rhombs, circles, parallelograms, ellipses, and other geometrical terms, or by words of art drawn from music, needless here to repeat. I observed in the king's kitchen all sorts of mathematical and musical instruments, after the figures of which they cut up the joints that were served to His Majesty's table. Their houses are very ill-built, the walls bevel without one right angle in any apartment, and this defect arises from the contempt they bear to practical geometry, which they despise as vulgar and mechanic. Those instructions they give being too refined for the intellects of their workmen, which occasions perpetual mistakes. And although they are dexterous enough upon a piece of paper, in the management of the rule, the pencil, and the divider, yet in the common actions and behavior of life, I have not seen a more clumsy, awkward, and unhandy people, nor so slow and perplexed in their conceptions upon all other subjects except those of mathematics and music. They are very bad reasoners and vehemently given to opposition, unless when they happen to be of the right opinion, which is seldom the case. Imagination, fancy, and invention they are wholly strangers to, nor have any words in their language by which those ideas can be expressed. The whole compass of their thoughts and mind being shut up within the two aforementioned sciences. Most of them, and especially those who deal in the astronomical part, have great faith in judicial astrology, although they are ashamed to own it publicly. But what I chiefly admired and thought altogether unaccountable was the strong disposition I observed in them towards news and politics, perpetually inquiring into public affairs, giving their judgments in matters of state, and passionately disputing every inch of a party opinion. I have indeed observed the same disposition among most of the mathematicians I have known in Europe, although I could never discover the least analogy between the two sciences, unless those people suppose that because the smallest circle has as many degrees as the largest, therefore the regulation and management of the world require no more abilities than the handling and turning of a globe. These people are under continual disquietudes, never enjoying a minute's peace of mind, and their disturbances proceed from causes which very little affect the rest of mortals. Their apprehensions arise from several changes they dread in the celestial bodies. For instance, that the earth, by the continual approaches of the sun towards it, must in course of time be absorbed or swallowed up. That the face of the sun will, by degrees, be encrusted with its own effluvia and give no more light to the world. That the earth very narrowly escaped a brush from the tail of the last comet, which would have infallibly reduced it to ashes, and that the next, which they have calculated for 1 in 30 years hence, will probably destroy us. For, if, in its perihelion, it should approach within a certain degree of the sun, as by their calculations they have reason to dread, it will receive a degree of heat 10,000 times more intense than that of red-hot glowing iron, and, in its absence from the sun, carry a blazing tail 10,014 miles long, through which, if the Earth should pass at a distance of 100,000 miles from the nucleus, or main body of the comet, it must in its passage be set on fire and reduced to ashes. That the sun, daily spending its rays without any nutriment to supply them, will at last be wholly consumed and annihilated, which must be attended with the destruction of this Earth, and all the planets that receive their light from it. They are so perpetually alarmed with the apprehensions of these and the like impending dangers that they can neither sleep quietly in their beds nor have any relish for the common pleasures and amusements of life. When they meet an acquaintance in the morning, the first question is about the sun's health, how he looked at his setting and rising, and what hopes they have to avoid the stroke of the approaching comet. This conversation they are apt to run into with the same temper that boys discover in delighting to hear terrible stories of spirits and hobgoblins, which they greedily listen to and dare not go to bed for fear. This may perhaps pass with the reader rather for a European or English story than for one of a country so remote. But he may please to consider that the caprices of womankind are not limited by any climate or nation, and that they are much more uniform than can be easily imagined.
Oh, yeah, exactly. That strikes me very strongly, because one of the things that's really weird about the 18th century English theater is that it's actually not very, I don't know if I would say it's not very good, but it's certainly not the theater of the Elizabethan era. I mean, the famous plays, nobody reads them anymore. It's like Oliver Goldsmith's plays, or like Addison's Cato, or things like that. Nobody really cares about 18th century Augustan theater. Even Samuel Johnson has a play. I've never even read that. Nobody reads that. But the theater, even though it was a very popular source to go and see Shakespeare and see Garrick play Shakespeare, and that was entertaining, and people would riot and, you know, do all types of crazy stuff at the theater, in terms of its literary value and importance, it really diminishes in this time and is supplanted by the novel as the main way in which people theorize and conceptualize character formation.
Yeah, that's true. It makes sense because like theater in like the Elizabethan times is still dealing with a not very literate populace. And in a way, it's getting them ready to be literate. Even England at the time is more literate than other places. But by the time you get to the Restoration, most people can read, which is why someone like Cromwell is even feasible in the first place, is because there's enough people like reading the Bible for that to be like, hey, we can all just read this on our own now. We don't need the Church of England and all this shit.
Yeah, and then the Restoration Theater had been reading this one little book about it. It's Heroes and States. It's by J. Douglas Canfield. It's about on the ideology of Restoration tragedy. So it's like very bitter last hurrah of the royal, you know, patronage of the theater, right? Because then after that, it changes over to private business theaters, right? Of Drury Lane and Covent Garden, right? They're private businesses and they become big companies. Garrick runs the company. He's like the CEO of the theater, right? And the whole royal theater system just falls apart after the Restoration. So the last hurrah is then in these libertine comedies of the Restoration and then the very bitter tragedies where the events of the Civil War are replayed on the stage.
Yeah, that's interesting. The only Restoration lit I really know is the Libertines, just because they're probably the most memorable shit to read from the time, like John Wilmot. But there's like very hardcore, very libertine guys with syphilis stealing each other's wives and things like that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this was a big tension within the Restoration era with the court. Hold on, I have a good quote, actually. This obviously it just makes England unique in this way. So compared to Versailles, compared to the European court system, because that maintained for such a long time. But the whole point is that in England, it's when the Hanoverians came in, they ceded a lot of room for the public sphere to grow. John Evelyn. So John Evelyn, his last memory of King Charles II, he says, "I'm never to forget the inexpressible luxury, a gaming and dissolution, and as if it were total forgetfulness of God, I was witness of the king sitting and toying with his concubines Portsmouth and Cleveland and Mazarin, a French boy singing love songs, whilst about 20 of the courtiers and other dissolute persons were at basset round a large table, a bank of at least 2,000 in gold before them, it being a scene of utmost vanity." And so you have that extreme tension with the Restoration between their libertine excesses and then also...
of like the Cavalier court, yeah. Like this is like exactly what John Wilmot's writing against, ultimate Cavalier guy. And he is like, I'm sick of these damn Puritans and I being an aristocrat is about being above good and evil. He dies at like 33 of syphilis after like abducting wives and things like this. But he wrote a satire against mankind and reason. It's kind of funny because that's sort of the like, isn't cancel culture getting a little too much, guys? Like the kind of rich libertarians these days, they're like, this is getting a little bit too much. Or you even see like a lot, some of the conservatives are starting to kind of tone down their moral scolding, I guess, of the elite Hollywood pedophiles or whatever. Isn't that the point of like power? like that, isn't that like the attraction of getting power is so that you can then do that sort of shit? That seems to be the whole point in the Cavalier system. But then like, what if you're like a Puritan, what's your point?
Cromwell closed the theaters, didn't he, when he came to power, right?
Yeah, well it's kind of more complicated because he closed the theaters, but at the same time, like, you know, the theaters closed all the time because of plagues and stuff like that. It's sort of like if you were to say that Trump closed the movie theaters or something because of COVID. But he did close the theaters, but at the same time, he reinvigorated musical tradition in which had music had kind of stagnated while the theater had emerged in the Elizabethan times, but like, there was like the magical and stuff like that. All of like the kind of musical innovations that were in the theater remained stagnant. But with Cromwell,
was it religious or theologically connected?
Yeah. It's sort of like the same way that a lot of the low churches or, you know, the nonconformist dissenters, they didn't like instruments being played in churches at all. It sort of goes even on to like the Shakers and the Quakers and the Ranters, where their church music is just like all vocal intonations. And there's even that like church that was in Pennsylvania somewhere in like early America where they had developed a pretty crazy like polyphonic form of choral chanting that like has been lost to us even today, because they were like one of the Christian cults that didn't believe in like having sex or reproducing, so obviously they die out.
You know, that's unfortunate. Because I could definitely see that. I didn't know Cromwell was a supporter of that of you know, music as a form of worship. It's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of interesting. Yeah. Like, because it's not idolatrous. There's no idol in music. right? And like, that's kind of an interesting part of this as well, is the anti-idolatry of being like anti-representationalism and like music in not being representational, but you know, this is sort of what Schopenhauer says about music making it like better than all other forms of art, is that it's not representation.
Right. It's just it's relational purely because it just.
Yeah, it's like pure form.
Yeah. I mean, that's the classic interpretation of the genealogy of the arts, right? Is that you have the understanding is connected to sculpture, especially, right? Because of its strict adherence to content. But then music is the opposite. It's connected to reason because it's just concerned with relation between emotions, where tones and musical phrases were considered to just have a purely subjective emotional content, and the purpose was just their arrangement.
Yeah, and the midpoint between those would be like architecture.
Or like literature, I would say.
Yeah, well, they're like the same thing.
Really?
In a lot of ways.
Oh man, I never thought about it that way.
I mean, like, I always think of it that way because I've written a book, right? I write books, and the way I think of it is a lot more architecture. Or if you look at Dante, the most important thing to like have in mind in Dante is what the architecture of the world path through the structures is, to have that sort of larger picture in mind. And that's like a big part of Poe too, is the architecture of a story, how you're led through a hallway to like recreate the scene of a crime and things like this. Tarkovsky calls it for film sculpture in time, which would be sculpture is timeless and music is purely temporal. Music exists in time. A structure in time would be architecture. Or a narrative of sorts.
That makes a lot of sense to me, just in terms of like how you actually go about composition. It has that whole building aspect again to it. But also the way that genealogically it's considered is related to the imagination specifically in terms of like faculty psychology. But that makes sense then that that's the whole purpose of imagination, right? It's exactly
the memory palace, man.
Yeah, exactly. But then that's really interesting to think about that way. Because another thing is Lessing and his aesthetic theory. That's the difference between poetry and painting. He makes a big point about it being the difference between space and time, right? Because poetry is in time because of its musical quality, exactly. And compared to painting or sculpture, in his work, he's making just a big point about the respective ways in which things have to be represented in each art. Obviously, they have their own methods where you can't paint things in the same way that you can in literature or poetry. Obviously, you have to use different techniques. So he's making a point like in Homer about you represent the beauty of Helen through your description of the effect that she has rather than trying to describe her beauty.
Yeah. I was just thinking also of the importance of maps and blueprints to creating narrative. The way that you would say, like, oh, I have a blueprint or plan for this thing that I'm building, and then you have to go in and actually build it, which may alter parts of the plan. I feel like that works the same with writing a story. If you're writing a novel, you have like a blueprint in mind of what the effect is going to be. Poe's philosophy of composition is that all of these things end with the effect. Reversal of causality with a poem too, where what you want to do, you have the effect that you want to have with the poem or the story, and then you have to construct the runway to get there, the architecture of leading you to that. And that sort of also ties with the way a Masonic initiation ceremony or something like that works, right? Is this sort of architecture. The metaphors of architecture, I think, are super important.
Yeah, I totally agree. That's what me and Ed have been talking about too. Then you could say, even when you say blueprint, that's the word project. That's the original meaning of the word project, is just as like a literal, like an architectural plan, like a blueprint, right? And then it takes on these other meanings as it goes on. So really, I mean, it is really deeply connected. There's lots of specific examples in novels that I can think of. One is The Gardens in Rousseau and Julie. There's a lot of discussion about garden plans and construction, right? And comparisons between different ways of designing gardens. There's in Goethe, elective affinities, like that's what the whole novel is actually about, I think.
Yeah.
It's just like a digression, is that Francis Ford Coppola, right? He had this crazy idea. He wanted to do like a 10-hour long version of elective affinities.
Yeah, in 3D.
Yeah. And but then
that would have been so tight.
He was going to change it to be about a film director. And I thought that was like perfect for the whole point of the book, because it is about the architecture and about design and about construction, right? And it's the same thing as describing production design of a director.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I always say film directing is a lot like architecture too, because you're not a painter. If you're a director, you're not, your job isn't, oh, like you're holding the camera, you're holding the boom mic, you have all the, you're doing all these things. It's much more like you're the architect or the project manager of constructing a building, where your job is more to coordinate a bunch of different people's work to create this unitary effect at the end of the completed building.
Yeah, and this is really significant too, because you can even look at the Winter King's gardens, right? The gardens of Frederick V.
Yeah.
Those had a whole alchemical aspect to them. There's a whole book about that. It's called Nature's Model by Luke Morgan. It's Salomon de Caus, the designer of the alchemical gardens of the Rosicrucians, Winter King Frederick V. The whole idea of the garden is like this, not only as like a microcosm, but the way that it constructs space and the ideological aspect of the garden in the 17th and 18th century, like really significant.
I mean, you could go back for forever, right? The pyramids or any of these sort of major construction projects are the center of any coherent order. These sorts of projects are what a nation is anyway, what a state is. We're all engaged in this collective project right now of whatever we're calling it, what building back better, creating the new normal, or the great reset, or whatever. Like, this is all one gigantic project, and then we're all being coordinated to work on it.
Yeah, which is so significant then, because the whole topic of this episode is about the fictional nature of the economy. It really is essential to the way that the economy works, especially in the way that it comes about in sentimental literature in the early 18th century. I mean, that's very important, because it's about, in the same way of building a garden, doing architecture, it's about character construction. You have this emergence of a public sphere that is directly connected to the fictionalization of property, the way that it's decoupled from somebody, the theories of Locke about nominal essences, right? It's the subjectification of value, of identity, is happening at the same time in this economic nexus. And it's leading directly into the literature having a very direct impact on this. I think people would be more inclined to naturally say that literature comments on economic phenomenon, but I don't see that as the case at all. Because of the fictional nature, the way that it's fictionalized following the formation of the Bank of England at this exact time, literature plays a very direct role in construction of the economy. It's not incidental. It's not secondary. It doesn't comment on it. It participates.
Yeah, you see that fully fledged in the creation of like advertising and public relations and things like this, is that things can't actually work if you can't coordinate everyone into a narrative about the world that they're playing a part in. People don't just automatically know what they're supposed to do or are automatically engaged in the project of venting themselves. That's not really how it works. You need to coordinate people with stories. Like, how else would you get anything done?
Oh, that's exactly what I've been all on about for recently in researching this episode and everything, is, you know, like if you look at the Austrian economist, right, and they're the way that they study the business cycle, we have like this, there's this whole branch of wave theory of studying economic cycles. And, you know, it seems to have this very regular cycle. So the pretense of political economy and neoclassical economics in the Austrian school is that, you know, natural economic behavior of people takes this form of this cycle, and that economists are merely studying this cycle, right? But then if you look at what the Fed chairman actually does, or the head of a central bank actually does, it's very explicitly, like, you can find them talking about, you know, this isn't like a conspiracy theory or anything. The purpose of the central bank is to manage expectations, right? And they do that through this economic forecasting, which is exactly what you're just saying, is that it provides a model of coordination. You put the cycle out there. You show people the structure of this economic cycle, this business cycle, and then that's what coordinates the economy around it. So it's like a self-constructing thing that they think is just being described, but it's not.
Well, it's like, even if, like, you know, like, what the biggest thing, the thing I can think of, right, is like the whole GameStop, whatever thing, is like, how is that even possible in the first place? It was like, well, you can see like the narrative construction of like getting to get people to be involved in this project of, you know, buying up this stock to like hurt the short sellers or whatever. But like, that's like part of the whole point here, which is like also why politics today takes on this sort of like alternative reality game. Like, I don't know. That's how I always interpret it, right? Is that like, it's to get, or like, to be an activist is to, like, you know, to be like a player in the game. Like, you know, you're on, to get on stage to, like, you know, take a role to, like, you know, people call it LARPing and stuff like that. But, you know, that's how it works, is you have to be inspired sentimentally through like a certain narratives to, you know, play your part.
No, that's exactly correct. I totally agree with that, because it's like, if this is what drove stuff like the tulip mania, so-called tulip mania, or like the South Sea bubble, right? Is that it's not just a naturally occurring phenomenon of market forces of people responding to like price incentives, as, you know, Hayek would want you to believe.
Rational actors or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, that's the whole problem. That's like actually the criticism that somebody like Max Weber or Gustav Schmaler makes about the Austrian economists, is that they have this conception where it's just rational actors, right, who are behaving only out of self-interest. And then through this, you know, process, the economy is constructed. But, you know, the point that somebody like Gustav Schmaler makes in the, you know, the controversies around 1900 is that you have to be able to consider economic agents in multiple different contexts of different institutions, like a family versus a firm versus a state. And that it's not self-interested in those contexts, but, you know, it's constructional. It's, you know, it builds up these higher institutions, these, you know, through the behavior of the actors who are involved, right? It's, you know, doesn't just happen. It's a collective project.
Yeah. 100%. It's kind of funny that it has to be said, because it just seems self-evident. But I guess if you're trying to brand this as pure rational science of studying nature itself, as the business cycle is just nature itself, the Malthusian population growth is just nature itself, then you don't have to think about the role you're playing on stage.
It's completely reciprocal. But the thing that really interests me is in the sentimental novel, because you point out, you sent me something of Rorty, right, is making a very similar point, but he's like making it as like a positive point of, we should do this. But it's actually,
he's kind of like the ultimate liberal. He's like the best liberal to read, because he's pure. He's like a very, very pure liberal. And a very, very pure liberal is one who's like, truth is just a word we use to describe certain things. We can't know the truth about anything. Truth is like a game that we play, like public sphere. The real important thing is the expansion of the sentiment of human rights, because there's no way to prove that people are people, right? Rationally, right? You can't like be like, how can you prove your own personhood in an objective manner? Because personhood is fundamentally not this natural phenomenon. It's a story that we've created in time, right? That we're all people. This isn't the case in antiquity, right? The idea that everyone is a person is an absurd notion to a society that has like slaves.
Idolatrous society that no one's a person.
Yeah, exactly. So Rorty's whole thing is the real way that liberalism will triumph is through the sentimental education of the world, which is basically like what America took up as its project in the 20th century, where we're going to teach everyone how to respect human rights through our pop culture.
Yeah, and that's so explicit too, but way back in the early 18th century, that's exactly what's going on. Because if you read Habermas, I mean, that's his point about how the public sphere is being formed, is that this is a whole new emergent, you know, where people are literally projecting themselves as characters into a shared public space. That's really an important part. It's directly connected to the decoupling of value from metal or land or labor. It's the same kind of speculation. And what the sentimental economy in literature is really like is it's a speculative economy of character, basically. Now you can project yourself as a constructed personality according to literary rules and techniques. And that's exactly what happens in the sentimental novel. And every author, if you look at it, is doing this in a different way or has a different opinion about the way this is perceived in society. Like Fielding is very, you know, ironic about it and very aware of the different ways it can be exploited. But then if you look at somebody like Rousseau or Richardson, it's very, like, they take it very seriously, where it's like the highest art form, and you get into this ridiculous, like, psychopathology of, like, sentimentality of Julie on her deathbed or carrying on for 100 pages lecturing everyone, gets taken very seriously.
I mean, it's serious stuff though, because this is like what people's brains are made out of. Their self-conceptions are kind of based on these, like the people who say like, how could anyone think X, Y, or Z when it's clear that all the Marvel villains believe those things? You know, like, what are you, dumb? Did you not watch the movies? Like, did you not get the point of the Avengers? That like, this is the bad guy and not the good guy. Don't you want to be a good guy? Like, duh. Are you stupid? Like, No superhero believes that.
Yeah, but I mean, you could see that even in, you know, 18th century literature, is that there is a very simplistic kind of sentimental literature where it's something like German Christian Hercules, right? That's a real book, by the way. But that's like the most simplistic kind of sentimental literature that most people were reading in the 18th century, is that it's not Fielding, even though Fielding, Tom Jones was obviously